Good morning, everyone, and Happy New Year. It's good to be back down here in sunny southern Alabama. It's so beautiful down here. This is my kind of January, but it was really good to be with children and grandchildren. Sandra and I enjoyed that a great deal. And so now we start 2019 together. And when it comes to preaching and where we begin with our first place, where do you think that I'm going to go? I'm going to talk about a psalm, more than likely, isn't that right? So we're going to deal with our psalm of the month, and as I was working up this particular lesson, I just got so much good information from the psalm that I've just decided I'm going to break it into two parts. I hope that you don't mind, but if you would, we can begin by learning from the sweet singer of psalms of Israel. We know who that would be, King David of Israel, that tells us so much about the power and the nature and the goodness of God that he experienced, that he knew, and he shared it with us through inspired language in the Psalms that we have. Our Psalm of the month that we're going to begin studying today is in the 65th chapter. I think the proper way to say that is the 65th Psalm is the way in which we should be thinking about these particular pieces of poetry and prose. And we're going to be keeping our minds on verse 11. Of the 65th Psalm, as it says, "You crown the year with your goodness." I want us to think about 2019 in that way, in which God is going to crown our year with goodness. He does that and has been doing that from ancient day. He will sustain us when this old world comes crashing down upon us. More than likely, we're going to be having trials and troubles and anxieties and turmoils that happen this year. They happen to us every year, don't they? If it be the Lord's will that we experience a lot of the pleasures of life in 2019, we'll also experience some heartaches in 2019. Some maybe more than others. But remember, God is crowning our year with His goodness. And David expresses that through the 65th Psalm as we study it together for the next 2 weeks. When you think about this, I want us to be focused on verse 5. Verse 5 is pretty much the center of the psalm, and I'm going to be looking at it in two distinct parts. And so we'll do the first part, Lord willing, this morning, and then next Sunday morning we'll do the second part. In verse 5, David says, "By awesome deeds and righteousness will you answer us, O God of our salvation, you who are the confidence of all the ends of the earth and of the far-off seas." You are the confidence of all the ends of the earth. Think about that expression as God desires to crown 2019 with His goodness directed towards us. He is the confidence. He is our confidence. When you think about this expression, remember the life and the time in which David lived. David lived in a very idolatrous world. All around the nation of Israel, in which he was the king, idolatry reigned. You think about his fights with the Philistines. Think about Samson's fight with the Philistines, remember, where he was battling their gods as he was battling the people themselves. We think about the time when God went through the land of Canaan and wiped out the Canaanites, much of that for their idolatry. God dealing with the Egyptians, much of that was because of their idolatry. Idolatry was everywhere in the civilized world in which David lived. Idolatry is everywhere in our world. It's everywhere to be found. It's everywhere to be seen in our world. And it's becoming increasingly worse and worse as time is going on. All the idolatry in this world as well. As it was in the days of Isaiah, it is similar with us in our generation. In Isaiah chapter 44, in verses 6 through 8, and Isaiah goes a long time as a spokesman of God, as he's talking about God and giving God's message to the world. Isaiah said in verse 6 of the 44th chapter, "Thus saith the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first, and I am the last. Beside me there is no God. And you can proclaim, and who can proclaim as I do? Then let him declare it and set it in order for me, since I have appointed the ancient people and the things that are coming and shall come. Let them show these to them. Do not fear nor be afraid. Have I not told you from that time and declared it? You are my witnesses, and is there a God beside me? Indeed, there is no other rock. I know no one." God is saying, no one is my equal. That is absolutely true. He's creator. The rest have been created by the one that is the creator. And we believe that to the saving of our soul. To recognize that very point, he is our confidence. We place our confidence in Jehovah God. And David spends a lot of time in this psalm talking and giving reasons why we do. Let's begin looking at 8 different reasons in this psalm that David expresses that ought to give us the same confidence David had. You are the confidence of all the ends of the earth and of the far-off seas. He is our confidence. Look at that expression in verse 6. Our God is the one who has established the mountains by His strength. Let me just say it simply. God made the mountains. And you say, okay, God made the mountains. But really it should be God made the mountains. Think about that for just a moment. Can we make the mountains? No, I tell you, with construction, we can do pretty good at moving some earth and making some pretty impressive piles in places. But we can't make the mountains. We can't make the mountains that run through the Appalachians. We can't make the Rocky Mountains. We can't make the mountains that are there in Alaska. We can't do that if we wanted to do that. Humanity, with all of our technology, can't even get close to anything like that. God made the mountains. It expresses His power by His strength, His power, the great power of our Creator. He has the ability to create the mountains. He has the ability to remove the mountains. In the first century, He gave them mountain-moving faith. Remember, He talked about the miracles they could do. They could say to the mulberry tree, be uprooted and go be planted into the sea. And by the power of Jehovah God, the God of the Bible, men could do such things. But it was only through the power of our God. I tell you, the power of Allah or Baal or Asherah or Diana or any of the other false gods in which the Bible talks about, or the gods of Greek mythology like Zeus or Hermes or whoever you come up with, they cannot create or make the mountains. And the God that is currently championed by modern day science known as evolution, it didn't create the mountains either. Evolution didn't create nothing. Evolution is not a God. And no, God did not use evolution to make or create the mountains. He made everything just the way He said in the inspired record known as Genesis. In 6 24-hour periods, our God, through His almighty power and His strength, created the mountains. Made the dry land rise up from the seas. That is the accurate and true historical narrative of creation, despite what scientists are trying to tell us and our children in this generation. It is God who has made the mountains. David believed it. We believe it with all of our strength. We believe the truth that God established the mountains. And notice the second of the 8 in which we read in this text. God not only established the mountains by His strength, but you who still the noise of the seas. I don't think I really appreciated that very well until I moved down into this area and got around the ocean quite often, and just how loud the seas can be. They can really be loud. Think about the one who's able to still the sea. Think about Jesus when He was in that boisterous storm that was occurring in the book of Mark. And He basically told the seas, peace, be still, and they were calm. I love the expression in Mark chapter 6 and in verse 51, the rendering that Mark has given of this story. In Mark chapter 6 and in verse 51, it said, then He went up into the boat of them, or to them, and the wind ceased, and they were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure and marveled. Now, first of all, Jesus walked out on the water. He walked on top of the water before them. No, He's not David Copperfield. He's not an illusionist. He actually walked on top of the water because He's God. He got to them in the late early morning and He stilled the sea when He got into the boat. And as you notice there, it said in verse 51, greatly amazed, beyond measure, and marveled. I think that's amazed to the fourth power, if my understanding is correct. Now, I'm not exactly sure how much amazement that is. That's just amazement beyond amazement. How about that? They were amazed. And when you turn into Mark or to Matthew's account, immediately they began to worship Him. They learned something from that story, didn't they? No ordinary man does that. God does this. God, we have God in our presence. Emmanuel is before us. God is literally with us. He's the one that makes the mountains and calms the sea. That's why we have confidence in Him. If He's able to do that, He can do anything. Let's look at a third together. Who stills the noise of the seas and the noise of the waves and the tumult of the peoples. I like that very much. Men can get quite loud. Anybody been listening to politics lately? I'm telling you, there's a lot of political upheaval all across the land, and a lot of different voices are speaking to a lot of different things. Concerns me a little bit for our country, the type of political noise that's going all around us right now. Noise, mobs, riots, tumults. Those things rise up and they scare people. A lot of times they scare people into submission. They cause people to go run and hide. They cause people to fear. Sometimes they cause people to compromise on their values and their dreams. They cause people to do things they would have never done without them. The tumult of the people. But what when man strikes out against God with a raised up voice, with a militia mentality, with a mob mentality? Well, really the first time we experience that is in the book of Genesis and in chapter 11. You may recall that. In Genesis chapter 11 and in verse 4. When basically the people refused to be scattered among the earth and repopulate the earth as God desired from Noah and his family, they said instead, come, in verse 4, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down, and there confuse their language, and that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the earth, and they ceased building the city. When God says, okay, that's enough, boom, boom happens. That's the way it is. It doesn't matter how many rise up. It doesn't matter the number. It doesn't matter if it's the majority of the people. It doesn't matter if it's every single person on the earth. Remember what Paul said, let God be true and every man a liar. When man raises himself up against God, it's a fruitless endeavor every time. How foolish it is. Going up to contradict and to rebel against the one that has established the mountains by his power and the one who calms the seas, how foolish is that? And yet there is an example of such. And yes, the same is true when it comes to Jesus. I love this story. There's a very quick demonstration of this in John chapter 18 that I really appreciate, that really helps set the story in my mind of the voluntary or the willingness that Jesus had to lay down his life for his friends. In John chapter 18, remember the story as we look in John 14, 15, 16, 17 of the intimate conversation and the prayer that God, that Jesus has with his heavenly Father in the Garden of Gethsemane, and here they come to arrest him. And so we begin there in verse 1 of John chapter 18. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where there was a garden which his disciples entered, and Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met them there with his disciples. Then Judas, having received a detachment of troops and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. A detachment of troops against 12 guys, pretty much unarmed. Well, they had a sword or two. We see a sword come into play in a moment. But you had a detachment of troops that had been sent. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that would come upon him, went forward and said to them, whom are you seeking? They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus said, I am. Now, I don't know if you what particular translation you're reading from there. The New King James says, I am he. The word he's italicized. It doesn't belong there. It never should be there. Jesus basically just called himself God in their presence. I am. And Judas, who betrayed him, also stood with them. Now when he said to them, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. Now what group of military militia is going to draw back and fall to the ground when they come just with a simple answer of, oh, you're the guy we're looking for? I don't believe that's the way Rob O'Neill approached Osama bin Laden. If my understanding of that story is correct, the moment he saw him, he said there was three things, two in the chest, one in the head. I think that was his remembrance of that. That's usually how military is when they come to arrest, when they come to take control, they come to take prisoner. That's what they're doing with Jesus. Jesus simply utters the name God, I am, and the whole garrison falls back to the ground. Now, why did they do that? The power of Jesus was on full display. If you happen to read Matthew's account, in Matthew chapter 26 and in verse 52 and 53, there when Peter had gone off and cut off Malchus's ear, Jesus said to him, put your sword in its place, verse 52, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Or do you not think that I cannot now pray to my Father? He will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels. That's where we get that song. He could have called 10,000 angels. He wouldn't have needed 10,000. Just bring Michael down. Michael could handle these guys in just a minute, couldn't he? When you read about the power of the angels of God, when you read about God's power, don't you think that I could call for reinforcements right now and wipe every one of you out with one blast of his nostrils, the Bible tells us, that God can destroy any opposition that comes up against him? We have every reason to have confidence because he's the one who has established the mountains. He's the one that stills the noise of the seas. And he shuts up the voice of the opposition. We're studying the book of Job. Chris, you're doing a great job in it, and I appreciate it. So I really don't feel any problem going this far away, as Chris probably won't get to this section of Scripture for another 6 months, 9 months, year, whenever, very end of the book of Job. In Job chapter 40, remember, God finally answers Job. And the Lord said this to Job, shall the one in verse 2, Job 40 verse 2, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. Job's response was absolutely correct. Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Hush my mouth. That's where we get the expression from Job. What a fool I've been. That's kind of the response that he gives. In the presence of God, that's the kind of response we're going to give. Whether we give it here or whether we give it on the day of judgment, we're going to have that kind of response. And they were silent. Silent before the Creator of the universe. Offering no excuses. Offering no reasons. Just shut my mouth. When God speaks, men should listen. We have every reason to have confidence in God. Let's go on. You can see why I kept putting this together and I can't do this all at once. Here's number four. You visit the earth and you water it. Water. If my understanding is correct, it is the most unique compound in all the universe. If it's not, it's right up there. You can't hardly find it anywhere. That's when they're going to the moon, they're looking for water. When they're going to Mars, they're looking for water. Because without water, there's not going to be any life. Water is very sensitive. Within just 100 degrees centigrade, you go from solid to liquid to gas. You got all three of the components of any solvent in such a very limited temperature range. And not only that, it's the only solvent I know of that freezes from top to bottom. Everything else freezes from bottom to top, based on PV versus NRT. The idea of the pressure on top of it just causes it to go from the bottom up. But water's not like that because it has something very unique, something called hydrogen bonding that kind of defies any other type of chemical reaction. We know it has to be that way. Our fish still live in the midst of winter, doesn't it? Up there in Michigan, all those lakes are frozen over. But the fish are under the liquid water where the frozen water is there on the top. And God made us this way. We're about 85 to 90% water, folks. We're all about water on the inside. I remember the organic chemistry teacher, as he would chide me from time to time. We teased each other often when I was in college. And he'd look at me and say, "Sills, you know you're only worth about $6 of protein all burnt up." And he says, "And I wonder if you're worth $6 of that." And he was pretty much right. We're nothing but just a small pile of ash and a bunch of water. Water, how important it is. And God has blessed us with water, abundant water, water all over the earth. He's placed this planet just in the right spot from the sun so that we can have not only solid but liquid and gaseous water. Our God is the one that makes that possible. And yet we still pray, don't we? There's famous songs, "Lord, make it rain." They send the Indian medicine men to pound the drums. Make it rain. We need the rain so bad. But our God, He visits the earth and He waters it. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 45, He says that He allows the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. Now, He has set this world up with a series of biological, chemical, physical type of laws. But He hasn't just let them operate on their own like the deists would like to think, like God sitting up there twiddling His thumbs in heaven. No, He's intimately involved still with humanity. That's why we pray to Him, by the way. Because we're asking for His providential care. And in the midst of discussion about God's providential care in James chapter 5, in verse 17, James reminds Christians, Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed earnestly that it would not rain. It did not rain on the land for 3 years and 6 months. And he prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth produced fruit. When it says heaven gave rain, that means God allowed the heavens to open up and provide the rain. That's what that means. You visit the earth and you water it. Let's look at one that is closely connected with this expression, the fifth one of the eight that gives us confidence. The river of God is full. Sandra and I just came back from Tennessee after being with our grandbabies, and we went over top of the Delta, and it wasn't just one river that was full, all five of them were. Big time full. Had a lot of rain, I've understood, that basically we left, it rained, and we came back and it quit raining. I hope that's a good omen, I really do. But it was raining up there too, it was raining all over the country. God is the one that fills up the rivers, doesn't He? And, you know, His power does that. Man can't do this. You know, man can go through in a very small scale and create the rain, the water cycle. You know, man has been able to figure out what that water cycle is, and he's been able to produce in a laboratory or in various ways clouds and be able to cause it to rain and do all of that on a very small scale. But he can't do it the scale of Alabama. He can't do it the scale of Texas. He can't do it the scale of the United States of America. It is God that supplies this for us, even in our great day. And yet, we continue to look down through this. We see where it is Jehovah God that provides the grain. I know this seems obvious to us, but sometimes I wonder, you know, I have that tendency. I'll walk into the Walmart and say, "Man, they only got 5 different types of that particular brand I want, but that's not good enough. I want number 6 at a lower price." We complain about Walmart not having enough. We're so blessed. We're blessed to have a Walmart. You say, "I don't like Walmart." We're blessed to have a Walmart. We're blessed to have all types of different stores that we can go to. So, goods are so easy at our disposal. And we live in a generation, it's like, I don't feel like getting dressed. I think I'll just order it online and have them ship it directly to my house. Man, how blessed we are. God has provided us the grain. When I stop and think about this, I think about Sandra's family. Now, I wasn't raised this way, and Sandra really wasn't raised this way, although she had much closer than I was, but every now and then I got the pleasure of going to Tompkinsville, and I kind of got I saw it. I saw it with her grandparents, and I saw it with her aunts and uncles. They had huge gardens, and they would put up everything under the sun. And I've heard the stories that back in the day, basically you went to the store and you got flour, and then you pretty much ate what you grew and what you allowed to graze in your fields, and you butchered it and all that kind of stuff. You basically, God provided everything from the ground for you to eat. If we had to live like that, maybe more people would have an appreciation of God providing the grain for us. I go back to the Psalms, and since we're studying the Psalms, the 78th Psalm, since I'm running out of time, I'm going to have to cut this a little bit shorter than I want to. But you may recall the time when the Israelites were in the wilderness and griping about, we're not getting any meat, God. What's your problem? Why aren't we getting meat? And so there in verse 26, he caused an east wind to blow, Psalm 78 in the heavens. And by his power he brought in the south wind. He also rained meat on them like the dust, feathered fowl like the sand of the seas. And he let them fall in the midst of their camp and all around their dwelling. So they ate and were filled. For he gave them their own desire. They were not deprived of their cravings. But while their food was still in their mouths, the wrath of God came upon them and slew the stoutest of them and struck down the choice men of Israel. They didn't appreciate God providing their, that says grain, but God providing for them in the wilderness. I wonder how many religious in our generation are like that today and are really worthy of God's wrath. Quickly, let's look at number 7. Your water, you water its ridges abundantly. You settle its furrows. You make it soft with showers. You bless its growth. Boy, did I ever see that when I lived in Indiana. You know, this time in winter, if the fields weren't covered with snow, most of them were partially covered with water, just waiting for the spring plows to hit them. Everything in its own time. There's a time to plant and there's a time to harvest that which has been planted. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and in verse 2. God makes that possible. God does all of that type of thing. You know, irrigation is a great thing, but if we had to depend on irrigation alone, we wouldn't have near the crops that we have in our generation. And speaking of that, the pastures are clothed with flocks, the valleys are covered with grain. Again, that reminds me once again of Indiana. You go to Indiana and that's what you see. You ever watch the movie Hoosiers? You got cornfields next to cornfields, next to soybean fields, next to wheat fields, and then there is a field that's got a bunch of cattle in it. That's Indiana pretty much. You know, Alabama has quite a bit of that. There's Angus cows all over the place around here. I look at that and I think about dinner. I really do. And then I look, and especially in the fall, and I see the Alabama snow or the cotton fields. That's my kind of snow, folks, the Alabama cotton fields. I appreciate that. It is the same God in Indiana that's down here in Alabama that takes care of us and fills up our fields for us. And not only that, but we get big redfish down here. They don't have those in Indiana, by the way. God provides those too. So I finish up by looking at verse 5 this morning. By awesome deeds and righteousness, you will answer us, O God of our salvation. You are the confidence of all the ends of the earth and of the far-off seas. This is a great time of the year, the beginning of the year, to begin thinking about God just like this and letting God begin to mold and shape you and help you grow and develop spiritually. Place all of your trust and confidence in Him. Start off the new year right, and He will crown this year with His goodness. Give your heart and life to Him. If you're not yet a Christian, you can become one by believing that Jesus is the Christ, turning away from a sinful lifestyle, turning to Him, and beginning that turning process by being baptized into His death, burial, and resurrection for the remission of your sins. My brother, sister, if you've fallen off the straight and narrow way, come on back. Think of God again in this term. Give your heart, rededicate your life, turn away from a life of sin, and once again strive to live faithful unto death. He'll give you the crown of life. Is there someone in the audience who would like to do that? Please come to the front while we stand and sing this song together.